Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. And coming up in a little bit, we're going to be talking about this great story. It was in the Tribune about the old school sign painters, you know, like when you see lettuce, head of lettuce for 99 cents, that kind of thing. That they're still using those signs at stores, and they're a group of people who actually still make an art form out of it. And we're going to talk about that, and then remember things that we miss, like businesses and places that used to be around in Chicago. We're going to reminisce a little bit this morning. And then we'll also have another edition of the Celebrity Name Game coming up. But right now, we want to welcome to the show one of our favorite guests, Rod Pyle. He's an award-winning space author and a documentary maker. His current books include Amazing Stories of the Space Age and Blueprint for a Battlestar. We got some new space news to talk about, and let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, how are you?
Good. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, good. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
It's always a pleasure to be back, and such a thrill to have you back in the seat.
All right. So give everybody a little background. We always like to do a little Rod Pyle 101 for people.
Well, I grew up during the space age, so I got to see all that stuff happen, starting with the very late Gemini flights. And by the time I was about 11, 12 years old, there were these incredible missions of exploration heading off to the moon for a while there, about every 2 months. That's really hard to imagine today.
It is.
Sort of been trying to get back to that for a long time. Still working on it. Getting closer. And, you know, I went to UCLA for about 8 minutes in the astronomy program until I realized it was all math, decided I'd better learn to talk about it instead, and here I am writing books.
There you go. So here you are, and we've got some stories to talk about. People can check out the website at pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. But we have a link up on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. So talk a little bit, first of all, before we jump into some of the latest news, Blueprint for a Battlestar. I really love that book. Tell everybody about that one.
That was kind of an interesting commission because it came out of nowhere, and it was originally going to be called How to Design a Death Star, How to Build a Death Star, I think it was. And so we were sort of working around that premise. It was with this publisher in the UK. And right about the time we started getting that ready to go, the word came down that Disney was buying the Star Wars franchise, and they kind of went, ooh. Copyright.
Yeah.
Battlestar instead, but we still have a chapter about the Death Star. I believe they changed the name to Death Planet, and lightsabers are called light swords. But, you know, there's some certain accommodation you've got to make. And basically,
sure.
It's the science of sci-fi. We kind of put the boundary at about 20 years out. So we didn't want to do teleportation and stuff that was really far away. But anything else, including interstellar travel, is in there. And it was a lot of fun to do. It was really a blast.
It's really a good-looking book, too, Rod. I mean, just a fun book to look at in general.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Thanks. It's actually, to my surprise, I don't know why I didn't think of this, but it's getting some traction in the STEAM and STEM community because it's a good way to outreach to kids, you know, preteen, early teen years. And I hadn't even really been thinking about that when I was writing it, but I've gotten some really great feedback from people, so I feel good about that.
Yeah. Well, it's one of many books that you've written, and they're all really great. And again, you can check out pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E-books.com. All right, let's talk about this. They launched a reused Dragon capsule, SpaceX did. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, this was kind of, you know, they're getting close to the first major hurdle in terms of the reusability question. So SpaceX has been, from the beginning, and when I say beginning, I don't mean when they started in 2002, but when they started working with the Falcon 9 a few years later, really always the eyes on the prize was for reusability at a lower cost. And I interviewed Gwynne Shotwell, who's the CEO of the company, about a month ago, and she said, now, people always misquote me. I didn't say we're going to launch rockets for $10 million anytime soon. We're trying to get it down from the mid-60s to the high 30s with reusable rockets. But even that's a big deal because they are the only launch provider that has ever published their prices online. You can go on the website, you can click on it, and you can price out your own rocket launch. I can, anybody can. The other guys haven't done that. So this was a big game changer. So this last launch, which happened just a few days ago, was the first reuse of a capsule. So they had launched a used booster previously a couple months ago. That went fine. Everything went exactly as planned. So the next test was to relaunch this capsule. And it's kind of interesting because this is the older capsule design that was really designed not for carrying people. It's for carrying cargo up the space station and then bringing stuff back and landing, you know, with parachutes and so forth, so you can actually return experiments and so forth. The Dragon 2 capsule will be carrying people, we hope, in a year, year and a half, 2 years. But this is a good test of a used system, and they're getting to the point now where they can bring back the booster, usually. They're bringing back the capsules, obviously, and reusing them now. And they're even bringing back the fairing up that covers the nose cone area and when they're doing satellite launches, and they're going to try and fly back the second stage. So in the not-too-distant future, they'll be reusing pretty much everything.
Wow. Now, is this, you know, the putting the pricing on the website like that, is that Elon Musk's idea? Is that his deal?
I think that was his idea from the very beginning. You know, the guy's a businessman. He made a lot of money out of PayPal and some other ventures. He's trying to make money out of Tesla and SpaceX. SpaceX has had the good fortune of attracting NASA contracts, so he's not just selling retail like he is with Tesla. He's got these lucrative NASA launch contracts, which he's fulfilling now. And then he'll be taking people to the space station, as I said, fairly shortly, along with Boeing and hopefully some others. But, yeah, from the beginning, he and Jeff Bezos both have said, look, the name of this game is reusability, and they're not talking about, you know, $1.5 billion per launch space shuttle, which is reusable but takes months of refurbishment in between flights. They're talking about, you know, the rocket lands itself. And you'll remember we talked about this before. It's completely autonomous. That's not ground control. That's the rocket and the barge shaking hands, saying, okay, I'll see you on the ground, and talking to each other. And then, you know, you hose the rocket down, you inspect it, everything looks good, you fuel it up. That's about $250,000 worth of gas, plus the time it takes the people to do it, and hopefully off you go again.
Yeah. And you toured the facility, SpaceX facility. Tell us about that. That must have been amazing.
That was amazing, and I've been waiting for this for a long time. In fact, I've been trying, this is for my 11th book, which is called Space 2.0, about the new space age, and I've been trying to get in to see Musk for about a year. And that just wasn't going to happen, too much going on. So I got to see his immediate lieutenant, which is great. Gwynne Shotwell's a very smart chief operating officer and has been probably, other than Musk, the key force behind making this company what it is. But they gave me about an hour-long tour beforehand. So you're walking to, you know, you go to a NASA plant, and it's kind of like an operating room. It's very clean. There's lots of curtains and so forth to keep, you know, plastic curtains to keep it sanitary and so forth. And they're usually working on one thing, whether it's the past a shuttle orbiter or a piece of a rocket or something. You go into SpaceX, and it's clean, but it really looks like a GM plant. You look to your left, and you've got rows of rocket stages going off into the darkness. You look to your right, you've got four or five engine clusters there, and there's people wandering all over the place, working really hard, most of them pretty young. And the sense of it is that everything is just enough to do it right. Nothing goes overboard, nothing short. It's right where it needs to be. And if I could just give you one example,
yeah.
In the old days with the Delta rocket, which started off its life as a nuke carrier, an ICBM, they cast or machined the stage of the fuselage of the rocket, and then they'd send somebody inside, or a couple of guys, with basically routers, and they'd machine triangles out of the whole thing.
Oh.
They call mass reduction, which takes months and costs millions.
Jeez.
So SpaceX looked at this problem and said, well, that's not going to happen. So I was walking through the plant, and I saw the second stage. They had these oval patterns on the side. And I said to the woman who showed me around, I said, is that mass reduction? She said, yeah, we just take a grinder and kind of grind the sludge off until it's thin enough. And I thought, this is like the way the Russians make a car, but it's perfect, you know, because it worked every time. So that kind of stuff was really neat. Last thing, went to the conference room, had the 40-minute or so meeting with Gwynne. But the thing that struck me was I'm looking at the table in the conference room, and, you know, you got a lot of aerospace companies at this big 3-inch thick granite or redwood table that the guys with the ties sit around. This place, it's a piece of plywood that's spray-painted black with a bunch of gouges in it because they've been beating the hell out of it for the last 10 years. And I thought, I love this place. I love this approach. It's really like doing it just right, you know, to meet the price.
Yeah.
So it was thrilling.
That was great.
If you ever drive by there, there's a rocket sitting outside. It's kind of like Disneyland.
Oh, wow. Well, how big a place is it?
Oh, God. It's a whole city block. So it's adjacent to an airport in Hawthorne. This used to be, I think, Northrop Aviation. So they basically took over this existing aerospace plant and enlarged it and modernized it. And the second you walk in through the lobby, you see this incredible machine shop in front of you that seems to go on for miles. And then to your left, there's this two-story restaurant. So you know, the good thing is you've got lunch right there. The bad thing is you've got lunch right there. You're expected to get back to work. And those guys work really long hours. So if you're heading out of there at 6 p.m., you're going to get a little bit of stink eye, I think.
It's funny. They, you know, I don't know if you watch South Park, Rod, but.
Yeah.
Oh, you do. So you saw this?
How can I not?
Yeah, you saw the subplot in last season where they were at SpaceX.
I did not. I think after the first decade, I didn't keep up.
Oh, okay. Well, they just had. I mean, because you know, the amazing thing about South Park is that it's so incredibly timely. They can do a show in a turnaround and get it to Comedy Central a day later. So the political jokes are as current as you can possibly be. And the last season, which was an incredibly political, like anti-Trump season, that it involved Elon Musk was a character and the boys from South Park were trapped at SpaceX. It was just hilarious. If you get a chance to see it, especially having now visited the place. I'm sure it's online somewhere, but they had a whole Elon Musk subplot. It was great. So the next SpaceX. Go ahead.
Just real quick before we move off of SpaceX, did we talk about the moon voyage last time?
No, I don't think we did.
So they announced a couple months ago, NASA came out and said, we're thinking about, you know, President Trump has asked us to review the next launch of the SLS, which is only the second one to happen later this year, probably next year, in 2018 or probably 2019. And they said, we're considering putting people on it. And there was some talk of maybe doing a lunar flyby, which.
Oh, yeah, we did talk about this the last time you were here.
We did, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
a week later, SpaceX come out and says, hey, we're doing that for two days.
Yeah, that's right.
No astronaut.
That's right.
So I did talk to them about that. And, you know, she wasn't going to give me a whole lot of insider info or anything, but she did say, here's the deal. You know, we got so many calls once we announced we were taking two people to the moon. We've got guys, rich guys lined up around the block.
Right.
Take flight. But they're going to wait. They decided that it would be smart to wait until they've started fulfilling their orders to NASA before they go flying off to the moon. So that's probably pushed back by 9 months to a year. But they're still doing it.
I think
they still plan to go to Mars.
I think that's a smart decision, Rod. I would. So
yeah, I think so.
The next SpaceX launch with a used rocket is going to be on the 15th of June, correct?
I think so. At least that's the plan.
Got
to have a window there for weather and all that. But that's the plan.
All right, cool. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, space expert, space guy, documentary maker, award-winning author who's got a ton of books out. Check out pylebooks.com, pylebooks.com, and we have a link on our Facebook page. We'll talk more space with Rod Pyle after we take a break for the news on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in. One artist, two songs, 2 for Tuesday. You program it, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for 2 for Tuesday. We're going to play a little celebrity name game. We're going to reminisce about businesses and places that we love that are gone in Chicago. And we're going to talk about an old school place where they still do the hand-painted signs for grocery stores and stuff like that. Really great article, an interesting one in the Trib a couple of days ago. All that and more, 312-981-7200, talk, text, 2 for Tuesday requests. Right now, our guest is Rod Pyle, an award-winning space author and a documentary maker. He's got a ton of books. He's always a fascinating guy. And we welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. And I want to pay you a compliment, by the way.
What's that?
I started doing a podcast on this West Coast station, KFI. It's part of the iHeart Empire. And I had never done one before. Always did interviews, whether it was TV or radio, whatever. There's somebody asking you questions and you respond. I discovered right away it's really hard to talk for an hour all by yourself without somebody sitting across from you asking questions. So what you guys do may sound simple, but it's really hard. So my hats off to you.
Well,
man.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I just have a great time doing it. And, you know, the contributions from the people that I work with, you know, Esmeralda, Dan, and Vic, and the contributions especially from my listeners, make it a joy and make it easy. You know what I mean? That's
good.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's a great job.
Perfect.
So, all right. So are you enjoying it, though? Are you enjoying doing the podcast now?
I wouldn't say I enjoy it yet. I get a lot of satisfaction out of it, but by the time it's over, I'm dripping with sweat and shaking. You know? So like, it'll when it gets smoothed out and comfortable, that'll be okay. I am going to start interviewing people because there's a lot of people out there more interesting than me. So
okay. cool. All right, before we get to some more of the space news that we want to talk about, you spoke at the International Space Development Conference last week. First of all, tell me all about that. What is that? Let people know what that is, and then tell me how it was for you.
That's a group that puts that on called the National Space Society, and it was started in the 70s by Wernher von Braun himself, actually, and then merged and grew, and they have chapters all over the world now. And their purpose in life really is to try and push the development of space, and that it means everything from infrastructure to widespread settlement. And settlement can mean a lot of things, but the idea is moving people off the planet into space to work and live. So it's a big set of goals, but they've been doing it since the 70s, and they've had a lot of success lately in terms of political influence. There was a working group paper that I was part of that was sent to the Trump transition team and got a little bit of traction. There's been some bills that were introduced that the NSS was pivotal in helping author and promote. So this is their yearly conference. This one was in St. Louis. 2018 is going to be in L.A. And 1,000, 1,500 people come together, and there's technical talks and screenings and just a lot of camaraderie and mixers so that people can really talk. And it's everything from top-level NASA people to the guy in the street. So if that rings your bell, it's the perfect place to go because it's the only place you're going to get that kind of access to that kind of information and those people.
Now, what did you speak about?
Well, I did a talk on my Mars book, which is coming out in August. And normally when I do those, I kind of go through the history of Mars exploration, which is really the JPL story. And that's where I'm working now. So I've had a chance to kind of dig in the archives a bit more than I had before. So that was great. This time I thought, you know, let's talk a little bit, of course, keeping Amazing Stories of Space Age in mind, right? I thought, let's talk a little bit about some of the missions we didn't fly to Mars, specifically these designs that Wernher von Braun came up with in the 50s and then again in the 60s. In the 50s, he was talking about sending a fleet of 10 ships out there with 70 Army guys on them. And they were going to go into orbit around Mars, and then three of them were landers, and the first one to land on the North Pole. And those guys got in a big tractor and drove to the equator and prepared runways for the other two to land. And they all landed horizontally with wings. Of course, that time we didn't realize how thin the Martian atmosphere was. If they had done it, they would have crashed. And then pivot upwards by use of cranes and blocks and tackles and so forth and launch back to Earth. So that was this military campaign, you know, to go to Mars. And it was a really interesting story, but it was just not to be. It was going to take 950 launches just to get all the stuff in orbit you needed to head off to Mars. So he slimmed that down a lot as the Apollo program was waning and tried to figure out a way to repurpose some of the big chunks of the Apollo program, like the Saturn V, with some new hardware to send just a couple of ships out to Mars. But at that point, the country was exhausted and spent out on the moon, and they said, you know what, we're going to do this, quote, cheap reusable space shuttle thing, and that was the direction we took.
Wow, okay. And how many people did you speak to? Or did you, what kind of a crowd was it?
I think that there was a couple of things. There was that and an author's panel and some other stuff. And they generally, you know, 50 to 80, I guess. And that's, you know, that's a big enough crowd for me because I can really make eye contact with everybody and then have a good conversation on the way out and do some kind of a quiz so I can give away some books to the smart people.
Oh, very cool. And now, and I have to ask you about this. You got to hang out with Buzz Aldrin's son, Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, tell me about
that.
That
was special.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I had met him once very briefly at this company that he was running for a while called Moon Express. It's a private company that's working on landers to go on the moon and try and pioneer mining efforts. He's not with them anymore. But we worked together on a board for this organization called Tau Zero, which is an interstellar spaceflight development organization. But we hadn't met each other for years, so I was sitting down at one of the dinners at this conference, the International Space Development Conference, and I got there late, so there was only one table left, and there was nobody at it. And I thought, I'll go sit over there and get some peace and quiet. So then I see this shadow in the fluorescent light, and I hear this voice, anybody sitting here? And I said, nah, go ahead. And I thought, I wonder who this is going to be. Oh, it's Buzz's kid. Wow. So that was quite a cool moment. And he's, you know, here's a guy who's, I mean, like anybody who's lived in the shadow of that kind of a parent,
yeah. You
really got to develop your own route through life. But he is a brilliant, delightful guy. He's got a PhD from UCLA. He's been in the space business for decades. He ran a big chunk of United Launch Alliance for a while, and now he's doing a couple of different ventures. He's in academia, and he's working with his dad on kind of perfecting his father's legacy. So it's a really wonderful seeing them together as a treat, and then talking to him just about life, you know, what it was like to be Buzz's kid, how Buzz is doing now, all the stuff he's going to be doing, because we've got the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 coming up.
Yeah.
Just about 2 years. So they're busy guys, but it was just such a pleasure to sit and chat with him for an hour, and I really felt like it was a gift.
That's awesome. And that's one of those times when you're happy you were late.
Yeah, well, I'm late a lot, so that was not a surprise to anybody. But the thing is, you know, it happened to me, but it could have been you or anybody else who went to that conference. So yeah. It was just this bit of serendipity, because he didn't recognize me. Because he meets 1,000 people a week, right?
Right.
I only meet an Aldrin once every 20 years. So I sat down and I said, Andy, he said, oh, you're that guy from Town Zero. Hey, Rod. So that was, it was complete serendipity. And that was, that doesn't happen very often.
No, that's a great story. What was the most memorable story that he told you? Do you remember?
I think mainly he was just talking about his dad's legacy, you know, and really, I mean, Buzz is, I think, 87 now. Mm-hmm. So there aren't a lot of years left to get done the things he wants to do. And he said, my dad has got so much on his plate. He is still so ambitious. He's incredibly vibrant. He's still physically able to get around and do everything he wants to do. And he's really, over the next 2 years, he is just going to be going at Mach 5, you know, because he's got all the stuff he wants to do, not just for the Apollo anniversary, but the thing about his father is, and Andy in his own way too, but Buzz was one of the only guys in that original group of astronauts that has really, since he got back, promoted the idea of moving on, getting on with it, getting out beyond Earth orbit, back to the moon, to Mars, wherever he's talking about at that particular time.
Right.
And most of the other guys didn't do that. You know, they pursued other things. They went into business, or some of them became religious pastors and so forth, which is an interesting story itself. But Buzz really kept flying the flag, saying, we got to do this, we got to get going, and please, let's do it now. So that's really where everything is focused, and that's pretty much what we talk about most of the time.
That's great. That's really great. Yeah. And you and Andy serve on the board together of this conference, correct?
No, this is a different organization. Sorry, that was confusing. It's a group called Tau Zero, T-A-U-Z-R-O. It's kind of hard to sound out, but it's a group that's focused on trying to enable fast interstellar technology. So not faster than light necessarily, although that certainly would be nice, but just the kinds of power that it's going to take to get out of this star system into the nearby one. So it's very forward-looking, but it's exciting because it's really out there on the cutting edge. So all the new stuff that's happening, you know, we've all read about the mysterious EM drive and so forth. When this stuff comes up, they've got a bunch of really smart people there. I'm not one of them, who look at the stuff and examine it, and we'll do critical write-ups of it and so forth to really figure out, you know, just how far we are from this and what might be the best approach towards getting it done.
Okay. All right. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Okay, we got more to talk about. Rod Pyle is here. He's an award-winning space author and a documentary maker. He's got a ton of books, including Amazing Stories of the Space Age and Blueprint for a Battlestar. He's got more coming out. Pylebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com is his website, but we have a link on our Facebook page at facebook.com/NickDShow. All right, more with Rod Pyle after we take this break on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. Two for Tuesday, get your requests in. One artist, two songs, you program them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/NickDShow. You will also find a link for our guests' books there. Rod Pyle is an award-winning space author, documentary maker, and we always have a fun time talking with Rod. And Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
All right, let's talk about this new astronaut class that NASA announced, or is going to announce. The new astronaut class that's going to be announced on Wednesday. And what does this mean? Can anybody be an astronaut?
Well, not quite anybody. I sent away in 1979 for the application packet because I thought, hey, I studied some science in school and maybe I could be an astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about misleading yourself. So I sent away for, I don't know, it was federal form TL-5 or something like that. So I got it in the mail, and with trembling hands, I opened it up, And basically it says you need to be a U.S. citizen, you need to have a bachelor's degree in a science, 3 years of experience in that discipline, and or 1,000 hours of jet piloting time. Well, the last one wasn't happening. Mm. But I had some science background. I thought, well, I could finish my science degree and maybe I could really apply. Then I started looking at, really thinking about the people that had gotten into the program over the years. And most of them have doctorates. A lot of them have PhDs and MDs. A lot of the engineers have master's degrees, but they've got some incredible. I mean, these people make overachievers look like slackers, you know, they're like the Olympians of space. So when you actually meet them and talk to them and spend some time in their presence, you realize that you are but an insect on their windshield. So that was the end of that idea. But so they opened up this new set of application, this new round of applications. They got 18,300, which topped their previous max by about 10,000. The biggest application pool they got before is about 8,000 in 1978 when we were ramping up for the shuttle. And I think that's reflective of two things. One, you know, space has been a little slower for the last few years. We still have the space station, but no shuttle. So I think there was a sense of waning there. But now with SpaceX, Blue Origin, Boeing with their CST-100, or I guess they call it the Starliner now, and all these private companies that are going to be stepping up to take astronauts to space station and American spacecraft again, finally, because they've been flying on the Russian one, the Soyuz. And then with NASA building the SLS Orion system, I think there's a lot of news around this and a lot of interest. So it really picked up a bunch of new applicants. So this is an 18-month process. They've winnowed it down to, I think, how many is it? Eight or 10, not very many. And they're going to announce them, as you said, tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's so amazing. Then they go into 2 years of training, and they start hopefully getting flight assignments. And there's I think, almost 100 astronauts in the pool, roughly as it is. Some of them will retire. Some will probably never fly. But, you know, for the last couple of years, you've had a really long wait to get a position because you're only flying one or two on each Soyuz flight at the most.
Right, right.
So finally, if we're getting regular access, these guys will rotate through faster. So that's exciting.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking at this story about the astronaut class, and I always go back to when I saw The Right Stuff. The training sequences in the movie. I remember thinking to myself, well, my God, what these guys had to go through. And it was really funny because, Rod, as you know, you've probably seen The Right Stuff 1,000 times. And it's such a great film. For people who have not seen it, you need to see it. I haven't not read the book. I feel like a jerk. I haven't read the book, but the movie is great. But anyway, there's this extended sequence where they show the guys who have to go through this training. And I remember the first time I saw The Right Stuff, its film is over 3 hours. And when it was first theatrically released in 1983, it had an intermission.
Right, right.
And the intermission was right after the extended sequence of the training, specifically where they had to hold their urine. And I remember because I had to pee during the movie. And I didn't want to get up because I was loving the movie so much, but it was excruciating to sit through that sequence because I was like, oh my God, I have to go to the bathroom. This is the last scene I need to see right now.
And not that I've seen it 1,000 times, but there were kind of two of those. There was the one where Al Shepard's trying not to pee in his spacesuit while he's waiting for his wife to take off. Mm-hmm. He says, request permission to urinate or relieve bladder. That was
right,
it.
Exactly.
Okay. But then there's that other scene when they're in the Lovelace Clinic in, I think it was New Mexico.
Right.
Where they've had, I think it was a barium enema.
Yep.
And they've got a cork in there with the inflatable thing. Trying to hold. They're walking down these hallways all together with this. Oh, my God. So much for being an astronaut.
That was, exactly, man. That was the scene that got to me, that scene in the clinic. That was the scene where I was like, okay, what's going on here?
And that was Mercury, you know, so they were really, there was so much fear in the medical community about what will happen when man goes into space.
Right.
You know, they had this real man in space thing. There were fears that humans would suffer separation anxiety when they got to a certain altitude and flip out, that they wouldn't be able to swallow, that they'd have trouble breathing, that their hearts wouldn't pump properly.
Right.
As it turns out, when you're in zero G, it's not too bad. Over the long term, it does some things to your body. But for a matter of days or weeks, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Okay, speaking of movies, I want to close out with this. The last time we spoke, you had not seen Hidden Figures, but you have since then. What are your thoughts?
I thought it was it had nice ambitions. It felt a little there's a little bit of a cookie cutter nature to some of the characters, but and primarily the Caucasian characters. But I realized they were trying to make a point. The Katherine Johnson, the main character, is obviously those three women are real people. She's still alive, by the way. She's 98.
Mm-hmm.
Costner's character was what they call a dramatic composite. So it's based on a guy who's often called the father of Apollo named Robert Gilruth. But it was also, I think, a little bit of Wernher von Braun and some other people. And I say von Braun only because when the directive came down from President Johnson to desegregate NASA, which was an order that came from the executive branch, von Braun was one of the first to really step up and say, okay, we're doing it right now. And this is a guy that, you know, he had a kind of a spotty background back in Germany in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
But he was right there, and he said, let's get the best people to do these jobs. I don't care about their background, their race, their gender. Get them in here. So he and Gilruth both really pushed that. And I thought, you know, I'm not always Costner's biggest fan, but I thought he was great in that role.
I did, too.
He played that kind of crusty slide rule guy just right down the middle, and it was perfect.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it a lot. My only major complaint, they made the Mercury capsule look like it was an RV inside, and if you were over 5 foot six, that hatch was touching your helmet. So it was a lot smaller than that.
Okay. Well, that's a small quibble, Rod.
That's not bad, is
yeah,
it?
No.
How about you? What did you think?
I thought I actually thought it was a terrific movie. Very entertaining. Obviously, I'd have no expertise in that world like you do, but I thought all the performances were really good. And like you, I thought it was one of Costner's best performances ever.
Yeah, and that bathroom, those bathroom scenes,
you know,
where she had to run across the campus.
Yep.
And I'm sure that's 99% accurate, and that just tore your heart out.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, I'm glad you got to see it. Rod, it's always a pleasure. And come back and join us soon, and everybody can check out your books at pilebooks.com, P-Y-L-E, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Fantastic. I'll see you soon.
Okay, Rod, take care. We're going to take a break, and we got the news coming up next on 720 WGN.